Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts, including TED Radio Hour, hosted by Guy Raz. TED Radio Hour is a journey through fascinating ideas, astonishing inventions, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to think and create. Find it on iTunes under podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we dig deep into the snow and ice to look at Disney's Frozen, and more broadly at the state of animation and Disney and kids' movies. Then we'll address ourselves to the sticky wicket of character deaths. Is there a right way and a wrong way? Why do writers knock off their own creations? And finally, as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies and theater and pop culture of various kinds.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, as we gather here today, we are about 24 hours away from our live show here at DCHQ, which you will not be hearing right away,
right?
But you will eventually be hearing at some point.
We don't even know how it's gone yet.
That's true. That's true. As you are hearing
you're
this,
hearing it, it's in
it's
the past.
It's already happened. It's
but
in
we
the past.
Are blissfully unaware.
And I choose to believe that we beat the weather. And the live show did, in fact, come off despite a slight weather issue. As I just said to Glenn, we will beat the snow miser.
Mm-hmm.
Not the cold miser.
Not the cold miser.
Because that's
thing.
Not a person who exists.
Exactly.
All right, speaking of cold and snow.
And people who do not exist.
Speaking of cold and snow and fiction, we all saw Frozen.
Yes, we did.
So Frozen is Disney's new film. It's written by Jennifer Lee, who also co-wrote Wreck-It Ralph, which we liked.
Yes, we did.
And she's credited as a co-director with Chris Buck, who's directed a couple of lesser Disney films like Tarzan, but has also been working in animation for Disney since 1981. It features the voices of Kristen Bell and Idina Menzel and Jonathan Groff and Josh Gad and Alan Tudyk as some of the folks that they meet along the way. So Frozen is about essentially two princesses, one of whom becomes the queen, and the one who becomes the queen has the power to freeze the world, and freezes the world, and then her sister and some other various supporting characters have to run around and see if they can unfreeze the world. Glenn, I'm going to start with you. What did you think of Frozen?
All right. I wasn't feeling this one. I mean, it's to say that it felt very familiar and formulaic is kind of absurd on the surface because it's a Disney musical. Of course, it's going to seem formulaic. It's got a formula. I never really saw the wires as much before as I saw them this time. That initial song, the I Wish song, as they call it in musical terminology.
Technically, the I Want song.
Okay, the I Want song. Thank you, Trey Graham. It felt sort of rote by the numbers. And then Queen Elsa sang the song Let It Go.
Mm-hmm.
That's when things changed for me, because that song, the song is sung as she exiles herself to the mountaintop because she has these magical ice powers that are putting others in danger because she cannot control them. She's basically an X-Man. And she must go and be by herself, and she busts out a song. Even if this song were not sung by Idina Menzel, this song would be the song in which Queen Elsa comes out as a gay man. Am I reading too much into it? Am I seeing something that's not there? I don't know. Why don't we let the listeners decide? Let's listen to a bit. Drag anthem. Let's just admit it.
Absolutely.
Is a giant. That song is already in at least 100 cabaret acts. It's already in 200 drag shows. Mm-hmm. When you call Joe's Pub in New York City, this is the hold music. I guarantee it.
It will absolutely be on the TV screens tonight at Show Tunes Night at JR's.
Absolutely. So we'll start with that. It got really good around that song, and then it just didn't quite live up to the promise of that song for me. Not enough jokes. We can talk about it a little bit more, but not enough jokes for me.
Glenn has absolutely put his finger on the button of why I was kind of grinning like an idiot at most of this movie, because as we've sort of touched on before, this is another story about needing to be who you are and how pretending that you're not or hiding your true self, you create distance and danger and drama.
Which is only the plot of about 85% of animated movies.
Right. Absolutely.
Fair. But still, I really kind of enjoyed it. I guess I knew that Kristen Bell was a singer somewhere in the back of my head, but I thought she was terrific. I want to give her all the sloths.
It's true. If you've never seen the video of Kristen Bell getting a sloth at her house, it's extremely funny. And we should remember to link to that, because otherwise Trey Graham's joke is going to really make any sense at all. Stephen, what did you think of Frozen?
Well, I had a little bit of an inverted reaction to a response I often have to films like this, which is, to me, a lot of movies like this front load their best material. So as you're world building, you're also splashing the canvas with a lot of jokes and establishing who the characters are. And then once you get into the rote plot mechanics of, particularly like in Pixar movies, a chase, mm-hmm. you know, of some kind of, I immediately go back to WALL-E, where like the first 45 minutes are brilliant, and then it becomes incredibly conventional. To me, this kind of inverted that. I felt in the beginning really cold to the, so to speak, to this movie. Most of the songs just fell so flat for me.
Yeah.
And also, you know, were a factor in how few jokes are in particularly like the first half of this film. Then along the way, and of course along the way, they're also adding little madcap devices like mm-hmm. the goofy, another like entangled goofy reindeer right. dog type creature.
Very like entangled.
Very like, yeah, there are a bunch of things in this movie that are like Entangled, though Tangled has more jokes.
Right.
They bring in the cute, silly snowman voiced by Josh Gad. His song has jokes in it.
Right.
But eventually, at some point along the way, first of all, they just completely stop doing the songs cold.
Yeah.
they just, suddenly it is not a musical anymore. It is, you know, an adventure. So I found myself appreciating it more as it went along and walked out of the theater, particularly because I saw it with not only my kids, but my mother. And my mother is one of those people who will not let you leave. You have to sit and watch who all the key grips were because those people worked very hard. And at the end of the closing credits, there's a lovely little gag at the end that is very sweet-natured and very silly, and I don't want to give it away, but it was like one of my favorite little gags in the movie, and I kind of walked out of the theater like, oh, that was, you know, there was that sweet little Easter egg at the end, and it made me very happy. But I did not have a deep and abiding love for it, you know, ultimately, but I ultimately enjoyed it.
Oh, you're also wrong.
I know you love this, and I want to.
You're also wrong. No, I'm just kidding. I did really love this movie, and I'm really interested in the description. I don't mean really interested as code for you're bonkers, but I'm really interested in the description of the plot as rote, because one of the things I love about this movie is it's incredibly subversive in several major plot ways.
Okay.
I don't want to give too much away about it, but I think you have to talk a little bit about some of the turns, and I will do the best I can.
Sure.
This movie makes a big play about true love.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then has a completely different concept of what that might mean than your average Disney princess movie, and goes out of its way to say, no, it's not this, it's this.
I did appreciate that, too.
The other thing is, there's a song at the beginning of this movie that Anna, who is voiced by Kristen Bell and is the non-queen princess.
The non-power, non-magic afflicted person.
Sings with a prince. And when they started to do this song, I had this moment where I thought, wow, this is really pat. And this is really very synthetic feeling, this song. When you see it the first time, it just seems like it's not a very well executed I love you song. Uh-huh. But once you've seen the entire movie, you understand that it's that way on purpose.
Right.
It's too pat on purpose.
No.
And when I went back and listened to that song again, after I had seen the movie, and I went back and listened to that song, I thought, wow, they have made a lot of really conscious choices about lines in that movie, like, we think exactly alike. It's magical. We're magically synchronized. We magically think alike. You're just like me. We finish each other's sentences. And my point is only that there are choices that are made in this movie, I think, for a reason, that they're taking advantage of the way that kids take a movie like this and watch it and rewatch it and rewatch it. And the more you watch it, the more you perhaps notice different things about it. And I think when you say it doesn't have jokes, I think there's actually quite a bit of humor in the initial kind of play between her and the guy who's voiced by Jonathan Groff. His little song that he sings about reindeer better than people is very funny to me.
Oh, there's plenty of comedy between those two characters especially. And I think the best song in the show is the one where they're in the woods with the trolls and suddenly there's this event that's supposed to happen. And they have this song about how he's not really great. He's kind of a fixer-upper.
Exactly.
I do love the fact that they're focusing, the engine of the story is the sister bond, which we haven't really seen. I mean, Disney did Mother-Daughter with Entangled and Pixar did it with Brave. So having something that's the engine is great. The predictability for me came in, well, let me put it this way. For a while there into this movie, you think you are getting the tragic supervillain origin story. And I think, oh, I'm watching Swedish Wicked, basically.
But you know that's not what they're doing, because it's Disney.
I know, but see, that's what I'm saying. I'm thinking if they had gone that far, because remember, Wicked is basically X-Men the Musical by transitive property. So I think they would have gone in the realm of more entertaining if they'd kind of pushed that a little bit further. Instead, because Disney is Disney, it must end in a place of moral uplift and moral instruction. And that just feels like it's closing down all the potential of this thing and not opening it up. I get what you're saying about how they're doing something different with various aspects of it, and I love the fact that the princess stuff, it doesn't feel like conventional princess stuff. It's less conventionally treated, but I did feel that I just wanted more. I wanted more jokes.
I also I hear what Glenn is saying, because if you know that the older sister is ultimately going to be redeemed, which you kind of have to know, then you have to wonder who's going to be the big bad. And then the big bad comes out of left field, let's say. And then the little bad, the little tin pot bad, seems to have a whole lot more influence in a kingdom that's not his own than he should.
And it's much less about a battle against a villainy so much as trying to solve a problem.
A problem of your own creation.
A problem that is of your own creation, but also is a, you know, it's a power that this woman has a very difficult time harnessing. And so it's somewhat like, how do you repair the familial bond, more than necessarily it being about, oh, this, you know, villain has to get his or her comeuppance. I will say, can any of these movies not be about princesses? Can any of these movies just not have princesses?
Of course. That's kind of what I said when I came out of the movie. Like, this is about as much as I'm going to like a movie about princesses.
Right.
You know, it didn't surprise me when I saw that the woman who wrote this movie co-wrote
Wreck-It Ralph. Right.
It's the same thing. It's a sort of, she has a fascination with taking princesses and inverting a lot of tropes about princesses, which I think it's good to have someone who wants to do that.
A great way to do that is to not do a damn movie about princesses.
I know, and I get
I'd love to see a ratio of how many princesses there are in real life around the world, and what is the percentage of animated movie population that is princesses.
Well, you know,
there are a lot of Italian princesses.
You know that I feel you on this. And my other sort of criticism coming out of it is, look, as much as I like these princesses as much as I'm going to like princesses, they are even more exaggerated in terms of their waists being smaller than their eyes. They really are. I looked at the movie and I thought, if you take her two eyes and you put them side by side, they're bigger than her waist.
Yeah.
And I would say, rather than going the direction of making that a less exaggerated, less freaky anatomy, as you might think Disney would be doing, they are going the other way, and they're making them even tinier.
They look more and more like Monster High dolls.
You know, they are. They look more and more like freakishly tall, freakishly narrow, giant-headed,
keen kids,
lollipop heads.
Well, there's an interesting point made. Tasha Robinson reviewed this movie in The Dissolve and started with a really interesting thought that I hadn't necessarily thought about, which is that every Disney animated movie is correcting a past transgression. Like, at least in the Disney movies of the last 20 years, that Beauty and the Beast is sort of going after this, she's harmless and helpless damsel in distress. You know, Mulan has a character of a nationality that is not usually covered. The Princess and the Frog has an African-American mm-hmm. heroine. You know, that each time they're trying to correct one of their own past ills, but they're doing it one at a time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would also say, just on a design level, the character design didn't seem to me to support the performances, the vocal performances, as much as specifically as even going back to just Tangled, where the differences between the characters was sharper. The performances were heightened by the design and the acting, the character movement, more than they were here. Those two sisters were supposed to be similar, but they were just so similar that they felt, I'm coming back to this word, and it's unfair, but I'm going to say it, generic.
Yeah. I'm really trying to figure out why I reacted to this so differently than you guys did, when we do often agree on a lot of movies. And if anything, I'm more inclined to be tougher on a princess movie than a lot of people. But I think this one, unlike Wreck-It Ralph, where I felt like the subversion of princess stuff was a little thrown in at the end.
Right.
In this one, it was baked into the story. In this one, it's baked into where this story is going from the beginning. It's baked into her interactions with the red-haired prince at the beginning, who has red hair like she does. They are alike. They match. And baked into those interactions from the beginning, very consciously, is everything they're going to say later about what's important and what's not important, and how you make yourself happy, and who in your life is the most to be trusted at any given moment. And there's a lovely, to me, story here that's coming around to the point where if you've been raised with a sibling and you are of, you know, marriageable age or whatever, if you've sort of just gotten to know your new boyfriend, your most trusted person is that sibling. Mm. If you're going to take a princess movie, like I said, I wish it weren't a princess movie. I wish they had made it about something else. But if you're going to take a princess, for me, this is the kind of the non-half-assed version of the princess stuff at the end of Wreck-It Ralph. This is really building the whole story toward that.
How did you feel about the way this movie was marketed? Because this movie seemed to me to, and this is, I'm not the first person to make this comment, this movie seemed to me to be heavily marketed as, you know, I thought it was going to be like Madagascar. You know, I thought it was going to be a bunch of wacky animals and a snowman going on wacky snowman reindeer adventures.
Well, I mean, they cut the teaser trailer very deliberately.
They cut it so no girls allowed, almost. Yeah, right.
I think that's true, but I think there were, as there often are, different trailers for different mm-hmm. audiences. And I did see a trailer today where it started off saying, who will save the day? And they showed the one guy and it said the Iceman, and it showed another guy and said the Nice Man, and then it showed the Snowman and it said the Snowman, and then it said or No Man, and then it had her kind of doing her thing. Mm. So there were trailers that did actually give you that tip, that was where they were going. But I'm sure that there were other trailers and commercials. I share your sense that I think from the marketing, I would not have gotten the sense that it was, as Glenn said, that the engine was that sister bond. But I just, in the end, for some reason, I walked out thinking I liked that very much the way that I liked Tangled. I think that I don't think I loved the Groff performance as much as I love him.
Sure.
I don't think he had as much to do that I loved as much as Zachary
Levi. He only sang
Levi.
For like 50 seconds.
That's right. Yeah. He does not really have a song. They don't really have a big song. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that sort of strange and unusual? And, you know, there's just a lot about it that I thought was worth paying attention to. Anyway, I really liked it. I also did love the Josh Gad snowman.
I was going to say.
He's not everybody's cup of tea. Mm-hmm. But for me, that guy, a Disney sidekick, is exactly what he should be doing.
You know? And I think that's one case in the film where Glenn's observation about the character animation supporting the portrayal is maybe less valid, because I thought that was a perfect fit.
Yeah. Mm. I did really. I did. I thought of Stephen's daughter when he kept saying, "Look out for my butt."
Look out for my butt.
And then his butt would fly through. I kept thinking about her because I thought she would think that was really funny. Like the whole thing.
Well, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree as far as comedic sophistication.
Anyway, come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us what you think about Frozen. And come on, be on my side. I'm way outnumbered, right? Okay. It may seem a little strange to transition directly from Disney to death, but a recent story out of the Seth MacFarlane universe sort of left us no choice. No choice at all. In a late November episode, MacFarlane's show Family Guy killed off Brian, the family dog. And there was immediately a petition to bring him back. And almost immediately after that, some signaling that he will indeed return very soon, meaning...
I can't believe that show would pull a stunt like that.
Meaning the whole thing was a great big stunt. But our listener, Martine, I'm going to say Gallardo, could be Gallardo, suggested that we talk a little bit about character deaths. And so that's what we're going to do. Many character deaths, it occurs to me, you have sort of several kinds, right? You have the kind that is involuntary, that happens when the actor passes away. Mm-hmm. Your Cory Monteith.
Right. Your coach on Cheers.
Your coach Nicholas on Cheers. Colasanto. Your John Spencer on the West Wing.
Your Mr. Hoopers.
I was just going to say, your Mr. Hooper. Your Mr. Hooper.
From Sesame Street.
Exactly, from Sesame Street.
Your
and then you have the ones where the actor chooses to leave the show, but doesn't necessarily die. And so you have a little more of a choice what to do. Your McClane Stevenson. And then
your Anthony Edwards.
And then and then you have your ones where you just decide that's what the story needs. Mm-hmm. And you go to the actor and you say, listen. And that happens several times on your Breaking Bads, your shows like that.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Your Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So, Stephen, I got the impression from your reaction to the news that you were not terribly surprised to see that this was in the stunt category.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, another recent example that I would throw out there is that The Simpsons, with sad timing shortly before the death of Marsha Wallace, announced that in 2014 it will be killing off another character as well, and kind of painting that as a big story, which I think is a little silly when, A, The Simpsons has like 900 characters.
Right.
And because they've killed off a bunch of characters in the past, whether it's somebody like a Frank Grimes that they kill off in the episode in which he's introduced, or one like Maude Flanders, where, you know, it's a peripheral character. There's some sort of, I believe there was an issue with the actress.
Yeah, the actress wanted to take less time, right?
Yeah.
And, I think Maude Flanders is who it was last time they did this. Last time they said
someone will die. They built it up in a big way. Now, they have said, that one of the producers of the show said the voice actor who plays the character has won an Emmy for the role, which means it's Sideshow Bob.
Yeah.
It's clearly Sideshow Bob. A character and joke they have beaten into the soil about 12 years ago.
I love that character,
but boy, they have exhausted. I cannot believe they have kept going to that character season after season after season after season. That, to me, is the obvious choice. I could be wrong. Mm-hmm. It could be Homer.
But you're pointing out there how the death of a character might be a positive thing if the character has legitimately run its course.
Yeah, I think sometimes there's nothing wrong with killing off a character. And there's also, on a show like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, is a perfect example of where killing off a beloved character is not a stunt so much as a heightening of the stakes.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we've talked about this before, but the one that I can't ever not think about when we approach this topic is Game of Thrones, which invests so much time and energy and emotion
in ritually slaughtering every member of its cast.
And we're not going to list them, and then we'll
leave you with a gut punch, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
or something worse.
Yeah, the danger is when to raise the stakes, it feels like it's coming out of just pure plot mechanics. I would argue that the Tara death on Buffy the Vampire Slayer felt like they were kind of, they needed to kill somebody. Who are we going to kill? Who would really...
Because that initiated an entire somewhat unsatisfying arc on that show. I mean, I think killing Buffy's mother was a much more certainly symbolic of, you know, what we've talked about, orphaning of characters before. Not that Buffy was a little kid at the time, mm-hmm. but taking away this crucial member of her support network, somebody from whom she had already been drifting away from, dying of natural causes, which right. I think was a very, very careful choice on that show.
Yep.
So I think at times, as much as that's a character, an actress I'm sure who was liked by people on the show and certainly very well liked by the audience of that show, it was very much pushing all the characters, particularly Buffy, in somewhat of a different direction as far as her support network is concerned.
And sometimes it does something not for necessarily the plot of a given season, but for the show itself. When, in the very first season of Star Trek The Next Generation, they killed off Tasha Yar, I was sitting around in my dorm with my friends going, phew, when's she coming back? Like, she was killed off early in the episode, mm-hmm. and we were all like, any minute now. Come on. It's Star Trek. Nobody dies. The red shirts die, but nobody else dies. And they actually killed off the character. And there was this little nice little moment at the end, a memorial service, which was something unlike actual emotion that we hadn't really seen in a show like that. Now, it would have been great to be able to say, and then the show went off to, like, say anything could happen. And no, it starts Star Trek. Pretty much the same thing happens week to week. But, you know, I can remember playing SWAT in the backyard with my friends. And they would all get into the whole idea of just like, okay, you're going to tactical this and go around. We're going to nail a treehouse. And I would say, I would wait for the first opportunity to get shot and lie on the ground, and then they would come over, and we'd have, go on, live! And then I would make them come to my funeral and say nice things about what a great cop I was, and then I would come back in about 30 seconds as my hot-headed younger brother. Because I saw shows over and over again where death is this little moment of encomiums, of just wonderful things said about the character.
Right.
Now, for someone like Roz on L.A. Law, where she accidentally steps into an open elevator shaft, you don't get that sense of it's all building to it. It doesn't feel like it's lockstep. It's meant to be shocking, and in
right.
fact, it was.
Yes,
right.
it was.
And I think the other thing for me is, do you make it do something?
Right.
Mm-hmm. If you're going to kill a character, especially a character people love, and I think this is similar to what you were talking about with it coming out of left field or not, you want to feel like if a character that you care about is dying, it's to do something. Mm-hmm. It's not just because they didn't know what to do and wanted to make the show feel important. So if you go to it, like we mentioned Henry Blake on MASH yeah. when McLean Stevenson left, I was looking today and discovered that that episode aired in March 1975. Hmm. And that is a month before the capture of Saigon. So you are still in the closing moments of the Vietnam War mm-hmm. when that episode airs. And so, I mean, as my mother always said about MASH, it was the Korean War, but the mentality is Vietnam.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so if you never killed anyone,
right.
it would
Absolutely.
Be profoundly dishonest.
Right.
And I think it meant something on that show. You know, another one I think that made often very good use of deaths was The Wire, mm-hmm. which killed characters at the time it made the most sense
for a character like that to be killed.
Mm-hmm. That it made the most sense and that it meant the most to the story and that it really advanced the story. It didn't just happen to be like, it's our season finale.
Right.
Something mm-hmm. big has to happen. It would be the product of a building story. It would be the product of building tension. And sometimes they could move people to the point where you'd be like, in this world that's been built with so much honesty, mm-hmm. it really feels like what would happen here is this person would get killed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it means something.
The Sopranos, to a certain extent.
The Sopranos was like mm-hmm. that, I think, also. And so when it means something, you know, and it's shifting gears a little bit, but there was actually a book. Now, everybody knows I'm a big fan of Jennifer Weiner. I've read a lot of her stuff. But she has a book that ends in a death that felt very tacked on to me. And it's the angriest I've ever been at something that she wrote. And it's because I felt like it was just stakes raising at the end of the
right,
story.
Right.
And I didn't feel like it grew organically out of the story. And my guess is that her point would be, sometimes it doesn't make any sense.
It's true.
Sometimes it does come out of nowhere. But it felt funny to me. So for me, it really comes down to whether it is integrated into the story, whether it feels like it grows organically out of it.
I saw a play called The Lions this weekend. It's by Nikki Silver, and it ran on Broadway for a little while. And it's all about a death. You learn when the lights come up that the patriarch of this family that's gathered on stage has terminal cancer, and he's got a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
So the entire first act is about them fighting over the hospital bed. And then at the top of the second act, the father's gone, the mother's gone, the brother and sister are in two quick back-to-back scenes, they are in very different places when the news of the father's death arrives. He dies off stage, but his death is so much the core of the story that the actors are able to register this sort of world of change right. with silence.
Well, August Osage County is like that.
Yeah.
And sometimes that winds up being imposed on a show because the actor has died suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I think about that with Coach on Cheers, where suddenly Nicholas Colasanto is just gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so his presence looms over where they're dealing with it, but they have not obviously had a time to let his character, you know, sit in a hospital bed.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you saw the Family Guy episode where Brian, quote unquote, dies, he actually does die. This is a show that is based on random references and context-free jokes that lack a point of view. They're just, again, they're just references. And it put on the brakes and did this very conventional sitcom death where we deal with the death of a co-star, which is just every red flag that this is not a real thing.
Right.
They're just totally playing.
It has to be ironic.
Every single one. And everything about this is saying, guys, this is they're going to do a do-over in this in any day
right.
now.
And you can capitalize on it in all different ways. You know, Stephen talks about Coach on Cheers. As sad as that was, and as much as I love Coach on Cheers, and I could watch Coach scenes on Cheers all day long, I also really loved Woody. And when they brought in Woody Harrelson and he came onto that show, I thought he was also wonderful. And there have been various cast changes that have not been as positive for
various
shows.
Various female bailiffs on Night Court.
Yeah.
But there are times when a show will figure out a way. And I think often it's similar to what they did with Woody, where it was something really different. They didn't try to... They sort of filled the gap without replacing the person.
Really, really different? You say that Woody is very, very different from Coach? Because I don't see it. I think they're filling that exact same dumb guy niche.
Different
they're
kinds.
Not dumb.
In a very similar
Neither
way.
One of those guys is dumb. Bite your tongue.
Okay.
Neither one of those guys is dumb. They're naive.
Okay.
And I will agree with you. What I'm saying is they fill that gap of a naive person who everyone kind of loves and cares for without trying to duplicate the same person. It's not another old guy. But it's not like they brought in another of Sam's old coaches, which would have been a very easy thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Coach's brother. It would have been a really easy thing to do. And that's not the direction that they went. And so they very much acknowledge the connection between those characters. But then there are other ones. Glenn, you mentioned Mr. Hooper on Sesame Street.
Right.
The death of Mr. Hooper on Sesame Street, they used as a way to
teach children about death.
Explain what death is. And even, you know, this was in, I believe, the early 80s. But the power of that sequence is still really impressive because it is so straightforward.
Big Bird, don't you remember we told you Mr. Hooper died? He's dead.
Oh, yeah. I remember. Well, I'll give it to him when he comes back.
Big Bird, Mr. Hooper's not coming back.
Why not?
Big Bird, when people die, they don't come back.
Ever?
No, never.
And it's very, very sad. And there's none of this, like, he passed away,
right.
he went to heaven,
It's really actually okay in some way.
Yeah.
It's really a scene about saying it stinks, it's terrible, there's not necessarily a reason, it just happens, you go on, there's still people who love you and care about you, but it's a really bracing message about death that I would be surprised to see a non-public television show give to kids in quite that way even now.
An actual character death because of an actor death can sometimes make you see the show in a new way. When Phil Hartman died and left news radio, he never seemed to me as like the cog of that show, what you would otherwise call the heart of that show if it was any other character. But he was it. He was the show. He's the thing around which that show revolved. And without him, you have something else. It's not that show.
I agree. There are certain shows that you just want to say, you don't need to necessarily keep doing that show
without
good. That person. And I think,
like,
and it doesn't
Archie
mean,
Bunker's Place.
And right. And
exactly.
You're not,
same thing.
You're not insulting the show. You're just saying he's so built into the machinery of the show. And I agree with you. I think Phil Hartman was that way on news radio. You know, they're a little bit in that position on Glee in the sense that one of the characters who had been a constant, who mm-hmm. hadn't gone off to New York and all that.
Around which the pilot revolved.
Around which the mm-hmm. pilot revolved, who had always kind of been the big, innocent, beating heart of this whole group and little community. I mean, that's a very sad episode.
The dumb guy. He's not the dumb guy.
You do not understand what dumb means. He's also naive.
I know.
In the pilot, he thought that he had gotten a girl pregnant because they were in the hot tub together.
Yep.
He's not dumb. He's naive.
Uh-huh. That's kind of dumb. Let's go with Lunk.
Unbelievable. At any rate, they did a lovely episode after he passed away.
Right.
And I didn't think that was a dumb character, but I did think he was a critical character. Uh-huh. And it's very hard to rebuild that. Very hard to rebuild that show, I think.
Yeah. Well, we've really left this on enough note.
Well, once again, you should come and find us on social media and tell us what you think. Tell us about character deaths that you think mean a lot or don't mean a lot, because it is a very interesting and very broad topic. And thanks, as always, for the suggestion, because we love it when you guys suggest topics. And that brings mm-hmm. us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, it is the time of year in which I request from my children that they write down all the things that they would like for Christmas. And then I get them none of those things. But I have a list in hand from each child. By the way, 30 items total, two combined list. 27 of them are related to Pokemon, which means that on about January 9th, both of my kids will stop giving a crap about Pokemon. around the time I'm perusing these lists, I'm sent a link to a recent article in Deadspin mm-hmm. by Drew McGarry called My Kids Insane Christmas Wish List Annotated. And it is filled with profanity for those who don't care for such thing. He is writing about his 7-year-old daughter, and so it is this mixture of practical items based on things that her friends have or things she has seen in commercials. One of them was $1,000.
That is practical, you have to admit.
Part of what's fun about it is, A, it's clearly a list that he has received, but he is going through, and at one point, his child asks for, quote, a little thing that can turn into anything at any time, to which he writes, what am I, Galactus? And he keeps coming back with a lot of them, where he sums up his commentary with just, you cannot have this.
Yeah.
And it is delightfully funny, and it really brightened my holiday shopping process.
Wonderful. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
Joanna Lumley's comic timing is one of the things that's making me happy this week. I had not watched Absolutely Fabulous in a long, long time, and I sat down this weekend and watched the first of the episodes in the new season they did last year for the Olympics. And Jennifer Saunders, the other half of the leading pair, has always had this sort of messy, blousy kind of comedy all over the place, very fussy. Joanna Lumley is so precise, and especially as a physical comedian. There's a sequence in this thing where she's trying to fit in a dress to go to a party, and she puts on the other character's girdle, and just the physical comedy that arises from that had me on the floor. So, Joanna Lumley, I love you. And finally, an article from the Journal of American History, which I found via Gizmodo. It is about the urbanization of the eastern gray squirrel. It contained many things that I did not know, which is always something that makes me happy. Squirrels were introduced into public parks in the cities of the eastern U.S. as a way of keeping people happy.
Worked like a charm.
Right? they wanted to keep city populations in touch with nature. And apparently before the middle of the 19th century, they were relatively rare in cities.
And then they unleashed a bunch of hawks to keep the squirrel population in check. And then they needed gorillas.
Then they needed gorillas,
to bring down the hawks.
Also, apparently, Ben Franklin had a pet squirrel named Mungo, which survived a transatlantic crossing only to be killed by a dog in 1772.
Ah, oh, tragic.
Squirrel trivia.
This is a death-filled episode.
Yep. Squirrel trivia with Trey Graham.
Mungo.
Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
If you missed a small film that came out this summer called The Kings of Summer because it came out against Man of Steel, you're doing it wrong. This is a film about three kids who run away from home to build a house in the woods. Every blurb I read about this thing was like, Glenn, stay away. It was like a gem, a charming coming-of-age tale, quirky. Everything I read about it was like, nope. But it turns out this is a funny film. It's not broadly funny. It is very precisely funny. And it's got a sweetness that has nothing to do with saccharin or treacle. It's perfectly done, really sharply observed, directed by Jordan Vogt Roberts, and includes small roles for Nick Offerman, Megan Mullally, and Mark Evan Jackson, who do great work with what they're given. The last time I felt this way about a film, like, I was 20 minutes into it, and I was like, please don't suck. Please don't. Please end well. Please nail the dismount. Was Hannah a few years ago that I didn't know exactly where it was going, but it was like, as you mentioned earlier, Stephen, just don't end up conventional. Don't do the thing where I know where you're going. And it didn't, and it's great. The Kings of Summer.
Nice.
Wonderful. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. I have two quick things. The first thing is that prior to Frozen, I saw the trailer for the Lego Movie, which has Chris Pratt and Will Arnett as Batman, Lego Batman, and a bunch of other people, and I really laughed. Yep. I think I laughed at that trailer twice.
Yeah.
And I thought, that is really kind of shocking. And this is, I mean, I am a devoted Chris Pratt enthusiast.
Right.
He's on Parks and Recreation. He's going to be in Guardians of the Galaxy. I am a devotee of the Chris Pratt. But I'm sitting here watching this trailer, and I'm thinking, this is really funny. Who I wonder who's doing that Lego guy voice. And it was Chris Pratt. I was so excited. Will Arnett was a little easier to guess. Will Arnett doing Will Arnett from facing off with Alec Baldwin on 30 Rock.
One way that you can tell if Will Arnett is in an animated movie is if it exists.
Yeah. It's true.
Speaking of, Linda, if you liked the sensibility of that film, if you liked the sense of humor of that trailer, you should be playing the Lego games. They're great. They're a lot of fun. And they have some of that same sensibility.
And one of the first things they announce in that trailer is that it's from the mines or whatever that brought you Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Oh, well, we like that. We like lots of jokes. The other thing is pure, as John Hodgman would say, pure buzz marketing. Somebody has to be the cheap person around here who tells everyone that downstairs in the NPR shop, as of right now, are our soft, really comfortable, it must be said, really soft Pop Culture Happy Hour t-shirts. They are a dark gray with a lovely kind of subtle logo that still pops with a little bit of color, and it's really cool.
They're the kind of shirts I wear even if they don't advertise something I'm on.
Exactly. And Stephen and I had a conversation over whether we were going to suspend the you can't wear your band's own t-shirt rule.
An actual question I have. This has kept me up night.
We should poll the audience.
No,
I think we should.
Stephen has worn NPR music shirts before.
That's Stephen. Come on.
I'm just saying, I feel that if I can wear NPR gear, which I do all the time, then I can wear our show gear.
Yeah.
But they're really comfy. They have them in the shop. If you come to NPR HQ, we have a shop downstairs and they have them there. They don't have them online yet, I don't believe, but I can't imagine they won't eventually. It's our first piece of merch bigger than a sticker. They also have some stickers.
Stickers and pins, but also pint glasses.
And we have some martini shakers. We have some stainless steel martini shakers.
Etched stainless steel.
It's very cool. It's very cool. The merch is coming in, and you're going to be able to come and drop all your dough and get some holiday gifts.
We are monetizing this, people. We are selling out.
Beginning to look a lot like Merchmas.
It is.
Nice.
And we are so excited. But look, as Stephen said, it's the kind of shirt I would wear even if it didn't have the name of my project on it. So what can I say? And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our producer, Lauren Migaki, at L Migaki, MIGAKI. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our In and Out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts we really think you would enjoy. For word games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts, check out Ask Me Another. It's a rambunctious hour that blends brain teasers with comedy and music. Find Ask Me Another on iTunes under Podcasts.